Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, a very special edition of Hometown Heroes today. If you listen to the show regularly, you know what the program's all about. It's about honoring our greatest generation. Each week we visit with World War II veterans. The idea is to honor them for their service, their sacrifice, their contributions to our freedom. We want to preserve their stories for posterity so those sacrifices are not forgotten. And maybe along the way, the rest of us not only learn a thing or two, but we're inspired by the stories we hear from our greatest generation on a weekly basis. Most of the people you hear from on this program are men, but tomorrow is Mother's Day, and of course it's fitting that we have a mother, a woman who did her part in World War II for the cause. And to set up the stage today for our guest, I want to read you an email that I got. And remember, if you want to let me know about the hero in your hometown, you can email me, paul@kmjnow.com. That's what Gary Olson did, and I'm going to read you his email. He said, "I really enjoy Hometown Heroes. I was thinking the other day that one of my hometown heroes is my mom. She never faced enemy gunfire, flew aircraft, or bandaged wounds. She built P-38s in Burbank for Lockheed. She was also a war bond girl along with her sisters selling war bonds, and they also were involved in the filming of Blood Drive films. I don't know much about that, but I've seen the still photos. They were a part of the group that met the Iwo Jima guys back in Burbank. There is a photo of this in the book where the doctor wrote called Flags of Our Fathers." So now this is ringing a bell for some of you out there. Gary continued, "You have probably covered this part of the war. I don't get to listen as much as I would like. It would be interesting to know if there are other former war bond girls in your audience. My mom is 89, so I imagine their ranks are dwindling also. Isn't that true? The unsung hometown heroes," Gary says, "are the ones who worked behind the scenes to support and supply those in the field. And if it wasn't for these people giving their talent, sweat, and blood, it would not have been possible to put a fighting man on the front line." He also added that his father was in Europe during World War II, and it's signed Gary Olson, as I said. So I thought it would be fitting, since we got an email from a son saying his mother was one of his hometown heroes, to have his mother on the program. So I want to welcome in, on the phone from Burbank today, 89-year-old Maida Olson. Maida, thanks for being with me.
Well, thank you for having me.
And happy early Mother's Day to you as well.
Oh, thank you.
Now, as some folks don't know the role that women played in World War II, there were millions of women doing something for the war effort, and we'll discuss some of those roles, but I want to talk specifically about you. You grew up in the southern part of Minnesota, sorry for the accent there, but I imagine it was pretty chilly in December of 1941, and everybody seems to have a memory about that day, December 7th, 1941. Do you remember where you were when you heard that Pearl Harbor had been attacked?
Yes, I was in Mankato going to Teachers College, and it was a Sunday. And, of course, we heard the news by radio, and we lived at the house of Kenny. There were a number of girls, and we had a house mother. And so she brought the news to us, telling us what had happened, and we were shocked. We were so surprised. The sun was shining that Sunday, but it was cold.
Well, I guess you do really remember it. And most of the time I'm talking to men who knew that they would be pressed into service one way or the other, whether they decided to do it on their own terms or waited to be drafted. For women, it wasn't quite the same. So I'm curious when it occurred to you that there was something you could do for the war effort.
Well, like I said, we were going to Teachers College, and then I was my husband-to-be. His name was Winfield Olson, and we called him Win. And he and seven of his friends enlisted immediately in January. And
I'm sure you thought that was a wonderful idea. You didn't argue with him at all or try to convince him not to do it.
I said, I don't believe it. I don't believe it. And I couldn't believe it. I said, well, you wouldn't all be going. And he said, yes, we're going. We're going to Fort Snelling. And everything was very exciting. And so it was very soon, and off they all went.
Was that hard for you to see him do that and know what he was doing, that he would eventually be putting himself in harm's way?
Yes, it was and it wasn't. It was such a surprise to see all of them there, all dressed in their uniforms and leaving, and it was kind of a heroic feeling, too, and it was a sad time, too. Well, the parents were there, and many of the families, as could be, were there to say goodbye.
Oh, I believe it, and I want this show to be mostly about you and what you did for the war effort during World War II. But I'm curious, as you send this man off to war, now you're not engaged yet or anything, you've just been dating there at Mankato State, but I'm curious what you did in terms of him being overseas. Did you write him letters to try to boost his morale? How did you keep in touch with him, and how hard was it to be in touch so infrequently?
Yes, we wrote letters, and he wrote very often, and I wrote very often also, and that's how we kept in touch. And because he was gone a long time that first time that he left, and I didn't see him for quite a long period of time there.
You know, there's...
And so my sister and I were talking, we had a sister in California, and she suggested, why don't you come out and finish your school after the war and just come out and we can do some work out here at Lockheed. And so we just decided to go, and we went.
So you go from frigid Minnesota to sunny California.
It was quite a change, and it was exciting, too, of course.
Now,
very different.
Was that competitive to get a job at the Lockheed factory? Did you have to talk your way in, or were they taking anybody they could get?
No, we just walked about half a mile and were interviewed by one person only and just signed in, and we took what they gave us. And mine happened to be on the P-38 final assembly line, because I didn't know anything about mechanics, of course, or anything. But I learned soon.
I bet you did. And this P-38 factory was in Burbank, not too far from where you live now in Sun Valley.
That's right, and it was just huge. It was a great surprise to us to go up in the hills above Burbank and look down and not be able to see the factory. It was all camouflage. All we saw was desert and trees and the camouflaging. So that was something unusual for us to see.
Oh, I'm sure, because this is still fairly early, and there's this fear that maybe the Japanese could come, and that would be a target for them.
Yeah, also there were soldiers guarding the place and everything. That made us feel good.
Now, give me the timeline on this. Pearl Harbor happens in December of 1941. Your husband not your husband yet, but the young man that you had been seeing has already enlisted, and he's getting ready to head overseas in the Army. And how soon was it that you moved out to California to work in the factory?
November, the following November.
So November of 1942.
Mm-hmm. Hired in 1942, November 2nd at Lockheed.
And I, in researching the role of women in World War II, I think our listeners will be interested in this. It ties in directly to what you're saying. Within 2 years of the attacks on Pearl Harbor, so by December of 1943, there were nearly 500,000 women working in aircraft factories. If you compare that to the number of women who, for instance, joined the WACS, that's five times as many were working in aircraft factories like you were. So you were not alone. Women everywhere were doing their part to help the war effort. And in terms of what you were doing at that P-38 factory, now the P-38 Lightning is, of course, a favorite of many World War II buffs for its unique design, its maneuverability. We've had some pilots on this program who flew P-38s. I bet it was a funny-looking thing to you when you worked on it on the assembly line.
It was. It was. And the assembly line kept moving constantly, slowly, but moving, until they just moved right out the door. But my part of it at that time was to install the fluorescent lights in the cockpit. And that was quite a thrilling thing for me, to crawl up in there, get into the cockpit, and do that. I thought I was really doing something at that time.
Did you have time to sneak a photo of yourself in the cockpit, or that would have slowed up assembly?
Wouldn't have been allowed.
We had to
show our purses or our bags or anything that we came in with, and I'm sure that wouldn't have been allowed.
After all, this is secret work, and it had to be protected by camouflage, as you talked about, the factory that was pumping out P-38s so they could go to work in Europe and in the Pacific. Was that a tough job, putting the fluorescent lights in? Is that something you need small fingers to do?
It wasn't tough.
Pretty
routine. But you had to be accurate.
Uh-huh. Well, and that, when I think of an aircraft factory and the assembly, and much like anyone who works in a factory for cars today, I mean, these are weapons of war, but you're going to have American pilots in these cockpits, and their lives depend on the workmanship of these aircraft. Did you ever feel a responsibility that it had to be 100% perfect, or maybe what you guys were doing in that factory would endanger someone's life?
Yes. Yes, certainly.
Was there a trick to getting those lights just right, or was it kind of monotonous?
We had a group leader, and he taught us. And then afterwards, then we just did it by ourselves. It was kind of exciting to know that the engines came from England, and it was a big, long row of engines, and I was surprised they were all from England.
You know, I often ask veterans about the camaraderie that they experienced, whether they were in an infantry division or they were on a ship at sea or in an Air Corps crew. I'm curious, in the factory, with all these women on the assembly lines, and we get the image, of course, of Rosie the Riveter, and that's the famous cliche now, but of all the women working in that factory, how did you get along? How was the camaraderie there?
Good. Good. I mean, there were, you know, a lot of different races and everything, and everything was, they were just very friendly. No competing or anything like that.
You're all in it together.
Uh-huh.
Since I mentioned Rosie the Riveter, I suppose I should ask you what your impression of that caricature is, and if that's something when you see it today, it brings back memories.
When I went to work, I walked through that department with Rosie the Riveter was riveting, and it was very noisy and very loud. And I was very grateful I wasn't in that department. It was a lot of noise.
I guess Rosie the Riveter is a little catchier than Flo the fluorescent bulb installer.
Uh-huh.
but that would have been you.
Mm-hmm. Now, later on, I worked in the blueprint vault. They had all the blueprints in a vault, and it was very secretive type thing. I mean, had to be very careful who came in there and so forth.
The blueprints for the P-38s?
Yeah.
So what did you do in the vault?
Looked up the blueprints when they came to get them and delivered them to where they had to go.
It sounds pretty exciting. And your sisters were there with you or no?
Yes, one of my sisters was the secretary. And my other sister, who happened to be a twin sister of mine, was a dispatcher. Our older sister, who was a secretary, said to us that there was going to be a blood drive for giving blood, and she didn't want us to go out and give blood. She thought it was too dangerous, she said. And so she would rather that we didn't go. And so we went, of course. And there she was, so all three of us were there giving blood. And it was at that time that that they were deciding to make a documentary on encouraging the public to give blood, to have blood drives. And so Warner Brothers came in and did make a documentary, and my sister and I happened to be in part of it, the part where we're notified that we should come and it was time for us to go and give blood. And so we did. And it was rather exciting because the cameramen were along and the script girl and everyone is along. And it was rather exciting thing to do, and we loved it.
So were these speaking roles for you and your sister?
No, just acting.
Well, and I guess even though that was nearly 70 years ago, I guess what's true today was true back then, that a filmmaker still can't resist a good-looking set of twins.
That's nice of you not to know.
Well, we might just have to get some pictures of you from that time to put on our website and show everybody that that indeed is the truth. And it's amazing how things work out, that you just go to do your part and you end up starring in a film, encouraging others to do theirs. And for those who aren't familiar and are saying, wait a second, a blood drive, why do they need a blood drive? I guess that's because they had wounded soldiers coming home who were going to need blood transfusions, right?
That's right. The documentary started out in the South Pacific, and a plane was shot down, of course, and therefore the need of blood. The film was shown in schools and in cities and towns and different places just to encourage blood giving.
Well, I have a feeling there are a few people listening today who saw that film once upon a time, and they're trying to remember, what did those twins look like? So we'll try to get the proof for them. Right now, we need to take a quick commercial break, but when we come back, we're going to have more with Maita Olson, a special Mother's Day edition of Hometown Heroes today on News Talk 580 KMJ.
This is Hometown Heroes, honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, a special Mother's Day edition of the program today. And before I forget, I want to wish an early happy Mother's Day to my mom, Linda, listening up in Sonora, and of course to my wife, Tanya, in Fresno. Tanya is an outstanding mom to our little girls, Avery and Mallory. I appreciate it so much. But this show is not about me. It's about the guests. It's about the veterans, members of our greatest generation who join me each week. This week, in honor of Mother's Day, we're talking to Maita Olson. And before I forget, go online to kmjnow.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. There are some terrific photos of Maita doing some of the things that we've talked about in this program, including some shots of her and the other Bond commandos hanging out with Bradley and Gagnon, two of the flag raisers atop Mount Suribachi, as famously documented in the book Flags of Our Fathers and the movie of the same name. Okay, back to the Mother's Day theme of our program today. Gary Olson sent me an email to tell me about his mom, Maita Olson, and she is our guest today. She's 89 years young, lives in Sun Valley in Southern California, and during World War II, she was pretty busy in the war effort, along with her twin sister. She told us about her work in the P-38 plant in Burbank, working for Lockheed, and how they serendipitously ended up in a documentary promoting blood donations, so there would be blood transfusions available for the wounded soldiers coming home. And that wasn't the end of it. Did you know that our guest today was one of the original Bond girls? I'm not talking about James Bond and those silly movies, but war bond drives during World War II. And oftentimes today people say, how can we pay for all these wars going on across the world? Well, the answer during World War II was very simple. The American public paid for that war by purchasing war bonds. And our guest today, Maita Olson, was a big part of that. How did you become, as I said, a Bond girl?
Well, it just happened accidentally because we went out that first time to give blood. We volunteered to give blood. And so we became acquainted in that way. And then we were asked to work on the Warner Brothers documentary. And then we were asked to...
to go help sell war bonds, right?
Yeah, that's right.
And do you think that they chose you because you were twins? Do you think that had something to do with it?
I do. They had blondes, they had brunettes, they had redheads, they had my sister and I, and two of everything, you know. And so we got to be involved in that, and it was wonderful. They picked us up in limousines and took us to fantastic dinners. We had lunch the first time with the boys from Iwo Jima, and we were supposed to serve them, so that was a great honor.
Now, when you say the boys from Iwo Jima, if anyone has read the terrific book Flags of Our Fathers or seen the movie of the same name directed by Clint Eastwood, they've seen the images of the flag raisers, the young men who raised the second flag atop Mount Suribachi at Iwo Jima, and how they were celebrated as heroes back home. It was a big part of the push to buy war bonds and to pay for the rest of the war to lead to an eventual Allied victory. And in that movie and in the book, some of these journeys back home are depicted. So it was one of these press opportunities, a celebration of the flag raisers at Iwo Jima to sell war bonds, where you met a couple of the flag raisers?
Yes, John Bradley and Rene Gagnon. I'm not sure I'm pronouncing that right.
I think you're right on. Now, and what was that like for you?
Well, that was really thrilling. It really was. And they just looked so young. And they were just such nice hometown people. We all just loved them.
Of course, Bradley's son is the one who wrote the book, Flags of Our Fathers. And in that book, he portrays them as kind of reluctant heroes, that they felt bad for being pulled off the lines when so many of their fellow servicemen were being killed at Iwo Jima and were still fighting in the Pacific.
Mm-hmm.
Did you get any of that sense from them, that they were kind of sheepish about all the attention they were getting?
No, not at all. They were enjoying it, as far as we could see, you know.
They enjoyed the attention of these Bond girls that were waiting on them hand and foot, I'm sure.
I think they were glad to do what they were doing. And, of course, they had the flag with them and everything. And that was quite exciting to actually see the flag.
And you had seen that picture 1,000 times by then, I'm sure.
Yes, yes.
So that was something for you and your sister to see this flag that had been immortalized in that photo by Rosenthal?
Yes, indeed.
Is that something where you wanted to go up and touch it, or it was enough just to see them holding it?
Enough to just see them holding it, actually.
Now, and I jokingly referred to you as Bond girls because of the James Bond phenomenon, of course, but they had a different name for you back then when you were trying to sell war bonds. What did they call you?
Bond Commandos.
Did you like that nickname?
Yes, in a way we did. In a way we didn't.
It sounds like you had a pretty busy social calendar. How often were you going to one of these functions to get out the message about war bonds?
I think that there were 7 war bond drives, and we were in all of them except maybe the first one. And we spent about 3 weeks at a time, and so we were busy. And they bought us uniforms, so we all looked alike. They bought us purses, and red, white, and blue. Purses and skirts and sweaters and anything we might need.
Well, that was my next question, and I will try to get some photographs to put on our website, kmjnow.com, and on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page so people can see what we're talking about. But maybe I can just get your description of what that uniform was like. You had the red, white, and blue purse, and what was the rest of the outfit?
Well, the purse actually, sometimes it was blue, sometimes it was red. And we had, like, red skirts or blue skirts and white skirts, different combinations. They wanted us to look different each time.
That sounds like every girl's dream.
Uh-huh.
A free wardrobe consultant, huh?
Yeah.
Did it make you feel kind of like a movie star?
No, but we did have opportunity to sell bonds with movie stars were there. They were promoting too. And we'd be there at the same time. And that was exciting.
Well, a lot of the folks who listen to this show, as you might imagine, are folks who were alive during the time period that we're talking about. They might be interested to hear some of the names of some of the movie stars that you hobnobbed with while selling war bonds.
Oh, let's see. It's hard to think of them now.
That's all right. No pressure.
Martha Tilton and Fred McMurray, and some of them that, of course, aren't living now.
Was there
the red-haired lady?
Lucille Ball?
Dizzy Arnaz and her husband, yeah.
Uh-huh.
And some folks like that.
Was there one of those moments that kind of stood out for you that was a highlight, that was a high point of this whole time?
Yes, it was meeting the boys coming off the plane.
The boys from Iwo Jima?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. It was meeting them.
I believe.
Realizing what they had, you know, gone through and everything.
Did you talk to them much, or did you kind of want to leave them alone?
No, we just talked and visited about nothing serious. You know, just joking and talking and And they were the same. They didn't talk about their experience in the war.
Well, that's probably exactly what they needed, was some small talk right about then.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm curious, as we think about this, and here you have this uniform. You're obviously chosen because you're attractive young ladies who happen to be twins, and you're here, there, and everywhere doing a job, and part of your job is your appearance. And I'm curious, as you corresponded with your husband-to-be, who's out there fighting in Europe, how much did you tell him about what you were doing, and what did he think of all of that?
He liked it. He liked it. And I told him everything I could think of and more.
Now, I've talked to a lot of veterans over the years, and some of them have saved the letters that they wrote back and forth with the women who would eventually be their wives, and others, since then, they've gotten rid of all the letters. How about you? Did you save some of those letters that you two sent back and forth to each other?
Oh, yes. We saved them.
And in terms of being the woman back home, waiting for this man to come home from the war and that noble effort overseas, is there one moment that you remember that kind of is, when you think of all the correspondence between the two of you, was there any that kind of held the most significance for you?
I think maybe it was a phone call.
All right.
And he called and said that they were wearing their boots, which meant that they were wearing their combat boots and they would be leaving for overseas. They couldn't wear regular shoes.
So he had to say it in code because telling you that he was shipping out.
He did say it that way. I don't know if he needed to. But he wrote it that way also. But they cut little things out of the letters whenever there was something written that shouldn't be written. They cut little holes in your letters.
And you still have some of those Swiss cheese letters with the holes cut out?
I'm not sure if I have that or not.
But you got some.
Yeah.
That were censored
just a couple. He was very careful.
And he actually got to come home on furlough while the war was still going on, right?
In 1944, in July.
And something significant developed during this time?
Yes, he brought a beautiful diamond ring, solitaire diamond ring, and presented it to me. And I was happy to get it, happy to receive it. It was beautiful.
So it didn't take you very long to say yes?
No.
But so here he's come home, he's asked you to marry him. Now you're engaged, you have to watch your fiancé go back overseas. That must have been tough.
I went on a trip to Mississippi to say goodbye to him. And my brother was also there, was also leaving for overseas. We knew they would be going to Europe, which they did.
Now, I've talked to a lot of people over the years, and like you, they wrote letters back and forth to him. I've talked to some guys who came home, and they greeted their fiancé or they greeted their mother, and the first thing they were told was how many prayers were said for them while they were gone. Was that something that entered into it for you, aside from writing letters? Was it something where you would think about them at certain times during the days or keep them in your prayers at night? Or how did that play out for you?
Yes, I did pray for him, and I prayed for my brother and our cousins. But especially, you know, my brother and for my husband-to-be, I prayed for. Especially when the newspaper came out with, I knew he was in Patton's Third Army, and that the newspaper talked about the whirlwind trip through France and Germany and Austria, and I knew that I was getting the daily paper, and I knew that I was following where he was going. And that made me pray more, though. Really, that was scary.
Well, that was my next question, because so often I'm talking to the men who were there on the front lines, and we don't often get this perspective of people who were back home but had them always in their thoughts. And was it a situation where you dreaded getting a telegram or a phone call that the thought of potential bad news entered your mind, or were you able to keep that out of your mind?
I kept it out of my mind.
No easy feat, for sure.
No.
And through all this time, you're continuing to do the war bond drives, and did you keep working in the P-38 factory as well?
Yes. different jobs. You know, I worked on the, at first I worked on the assembly line for the final assembly. And then, like, I worked in the vault.
When did you finally stop working there?
After the war.
When it was all said and done.
Uh-huh.
And they didn't need to make the P-38s anymore.
No. They were making the B-17s.
Wow.
When I quit. Or when we were told to quit.
And
it was time because, you know, war was over.
Well, and I'm going to ask you before we're done about how you found out the war was over and what that meant to you. But one more thing on working in an aircraft factory. I'm just curious, having spent the time that you did installing those lights in the cockpit of the P-38s and guarding the blueprints in the vault there at the factory in Burbank, were you more intrigued when you saw an article or a newsreel or read something about P-38s versus any other plane in the Air Corps? Did you feel a connection?
Oh, yes. Yes.
Is it something to the point that maybe you've seen a P-38 since the war and had to go take a look?
I've seen a P-38 since the war, but not lately. A day or so ago.
And I bet if you see one, you have to tell your grandkids, hey, I used to work on those.
I've told them about it, and they thought it was intriguing.
To say the least.
Yeah.
I think it's pretty impressive. Yeah. Well, I know you have a few more stories for us. Right now, we're going to take our last commercial break. And when we come back, we'll come down the home stretch with Maida Olson. She's 89 years old, but she doesn't sound like it, does she? And I bet she doesn't look like it either. We'll have the proof in the pudding on our website at kmjnow.com. And we'll be right back with the rest of Hometown Heroes here on News Talk 580 KMJ.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. We're going to continue now with our guest, Maida Olson. She's 89 years old, lives in Sun Valley in Southern California. And it's not too often that we get to visit with women on this show, but every year around Mother's Day, I try to do that. Tomorrow is Mother's Day, and I know you'll take care of business the way that you need to. On this program in the past, we've heard from women who flew airplanes as WASPs, the Women Air Force Service Pilots. Of course, they got the Congressional Gold Medal last year. We've talked to Army nurses. We've had WAVES, women accepted for volunteer emergency service. We've had ladies who served in the Women's Army Corps, the WACs. We've also had female Marines. Millions of American women were part of the war effort in World War II, but not all of them wore a uniform. Although Maida Olson, in a way, wore a uniform. They had the issued dress when she was a bond commando helping to sell war bonds across Southern California. And was that pretty much the extent of it? They didn't have you traveling all over the country, just in California, right?
Yeah, just in the area, actually, Southern California.
Which is fun enough, as you shared with us. We heard about how you did that, how you were part of a documentary encouraging people to give blood, and how you worked throughout the war at a plant for Lockheed in Burbank, building P-38s and guarding the blueprints for those one-of-a-kind planes, one of my favorite planes. The Germans didn't like them very much. They called them the fork-tailed devils because of the damage that Americans inflicted in P-38s overseas. And by the way, they are up now at kmjnow.com, as well as the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, photos of Maida Olson and her twin sister working in the cockpit of a P-38, as well as some of their other activities during that time period. Meanwhile, Maida, you had to say goodbye to a young man, Wynn Olson, who was headed back to Europe. He had proposed to you, gave you a sparkling diamond ring, which you probably didn't wear around the factory too much, huh?
No.
Had to keep it in safe, keeping it home somewhere. But
yeah.
As you wrote back and forth to him, as the war was dragging on in Europe, you're on into 1945, and you're following the headlines of Patton's Third Army and praying for him every night, wondering what's happening to him. When did you get the news that he might have a chance to come home?
He wrote and said that they had numbers. That's how they would be released from the Army, would be according to the number.
The points that they had accrued. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And did he feel it was going to be a while till he got out?
He wouldn't get out as soon as some did. Like my brother was in a year before the war started in Japan, started the war then. So he was already in a year, so those fellows would be released first from the service.
So your brother got to come home, and you're hoping that this other guy can come home so you can marry him.
Yeah. I suppose it was a difference of about 6 months, something like that.
Were you starting to get anxious at all?
Yes, I was. And I was wondering exactly what he would do, because he was very close with his family, and they were all in Minnesota, and I was out here. So I wondered when he would arrive out here. It didn't take very long, and he came as soon as I had hoped he could, and that was wonderful.
Well, tell me about it, because I so often I get the other side of the story. This is a treat today to hear from someone who wasn't overseas but was back home, and the home front was such a crucial part to the Allied victory in World War II. The role of women, very important in World War II, and Mato was a big part of that, as we've heard. But just from the perspective of someone waiting for a guy to get back so you can marry him, so you can start a family, so you can have the life that you were dreaming and praying for, what was it like when you actually saw him again? Where were you, and how would you share that memory with our audience?
Well, it was wonderful. Of course, I heard first about the time that it would be, and then his parents, I knew his parents were to pick him up in Wisconsin someplace where he would be released from the service. And then I knew they were driving to Minnesota. And so when he called and said that he would be out in a couple of weeks, I was pleased. And I thought that was just about right. And so it was wonderful, and it was exciting. And I thought he looked good. And he did look good.
He didn't look war-weary to you?
No. They'd had some time that they were in Europe after the war. And he spent quite a bit of time then playing softball. And he became a pitcher. And he was inducted in the Hall of Fame for his fast softball pitching.
How about that?
Minnesota.
Uh-huh.
And so that was exciting. That was in 1996. And so we all trips back to Minnesota and went to the induction. It was wonderful, too.
So he developed this love of fast-pitch softball in the service, and it's something he kept doing afterwards in the States.
Yeah, and many young men followed. It was
the fast-pitch World Series.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
And he taught many of them, and they became good pitchers, too. Now they have the slow pitch, which I don't care for that much.
No, it's a completely different
it's
sport.
It's too slow.
Well, we've actually had a gentleman on this program who's also in the Fast Pitch Softball Hall of Fame.
Really?
Who spent some time playing with Bobby Thompson before the war. But I don't want to get off on too much of a tangent. I do want to ask, because we've had a lot of different stories here. Sometimes a veteran gets home, and they want to get married right away. Other times he says, you know what, this young lady's been waiting. Let's give her a chance to plan the wedding and do it the way she wants to do it. How did that work out for you two lovebirds?
It worked out good. Did
you do it quickly or did you wait?
No, we waited for it must have been a couple of months. And time to do everything we thought we needed to do. And then, of course, it was time to pack up and leave for Minnesota, which we did. And that was kind of a sad thing for me in a way, because I was leaving my family. But he had such a wonderful family that it was worked out beautifully.
And you eventually made it back to Southern California after all.
Yes, we did.
I'm curious. A lot of the guys that are on this program, when they come on and they share some of their memories, some of the things are things that they've never really talked about. And for you, you've done your part for the war effort at home. You know what he's been doing overseas in Patton's Third Army, as you talked about. But after he got home, did you try to get him to talk about some of the things he experienced, or was that a topic that you'd rather leave alone?
He did talk about it a lot, unless you asked him questions. And course, I wanted to know how everything was, and you know, and if they stopped at people's homes and so forth. And he said, well, they did, you know, and sometimes they took sausages and bread and things like that. Otherwise, he didn't talk about the war part.
Did you ever observe any effects of the war on him, any way that his service on the ground in Europe kind of impacted him after the war?
No.
And for you two as a couple, and again, both of you having done your part for the war effort and now victory has been achieved, did you feel like you had a new life, that you had this opportunity that for a while maybe you didn't know if you'd get?
Mm-hmm. And it was just exactly what I wanted. It was just exactly what I wanted. So that was really satisfying.
And how many kids and grandkids do you have now?
I have 3 children, and I have 4 grandchildren.
Have you ever, and it's a bit of a cliche because I go to it all the time on this program, but it's so true. And people today, I don't know if they really grasp it. And I'm another example. If my grandfather didn't make it home from World War II, I never would have been born. Did it ever occur to you that, you know, how close you were to not having the life that you've had and to not having the children and grandchildren that you enjoy so much now?
Yes, yes, I've thought about that a lot. And I have been so grateful. I know that God answered prayer, and he still is busy answering prayer, you know.
Amen. Busier than he's ever been before, no doubt about it. Well, when you talk about that, obviously you're thankful for the life that you've had, for the fact that your husband did make it home to marry you, for the experiences you had and the fun adventures that you've shared with us during World War II. Mm-hmm. When you think back on it now, and maybe when you spend time around your kids and grandkids and you reminisce about that era, what was it about America at that time, about the people that you were around and the people that you saw? What was it that you think we need to remember today and that maybe can even encourage us or inspire us today?
Oh, I think that we were just honestly looking forward to what was coming and so on. You know, I don't know.
Do you think people today understand the culture of America during World War II, understand what it was like to have everybody in it together?
I think so. I think that we were all pretty much the same mind during World War II and afterwards, too.
I'm curious, you talk about your children and your grandchildren, and I know you've told them some of the stories that you've shared with us today. Which one of your adventures has raised the most eyebrows at family functions when you start to reminisce about being a Bond commando or working in the aircraft factory? Which one of those really captivates them?
I think working on the P-38.
You have any funny stories about some of those encounters with family and telling some of those stories about the reactions that they had to some of the things you shared with them?
No, but it's been a rewarding to me in a way, because now my grandchildren have grown up and they're in school, and they have been wanting to interview me to do this for a class project, 2 of them, which is, I said, well, that's kind of nice.
So did you tell them about it? Did you do the interview?
In fact, it just happened just recently. My grandson said, Nina, I took that book, Flags of Our Fathers, and I shared that with my teacher. I said, you did? And he said, yes. And we're starting to study now about World War II. So he was getting excited, too.
Well, that's really neat. And, I think we've taught people a few things today about what women did in World War II, just in the terms of some of the things that you did. Do you think people in general understand that it wasn't just the men doing their part in World War II?
Well, I think so. I think so. And, of course, I think those that, you know, had to stay home. Actually, those that were married and their husbands went off. I think that was much harder for them.
No question. Not knowing if dad was going to make it back to be dad.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, it was a very unique time in our history, and you've shed some light on it today, and I want to thank you for that, Maida. And,
oh, thank you.
In closing, is there anything that you'd like to share for those of us who weren't alive during World War II, what you think was most significant about what happened during that time and why it's important for us to remember it and reflect on it all these years later?
I think it was a time that we were all more one, that we thought the same and everything. And I think it was a time that we were all more one, that we thought the same and everything, and had closer friendships and things. It was a wonderful time. It was a fast-moving time. It was moving so fast all the time.
Moving about as fast as one of those P-38s that you were working on in the factory in Burbank.
Yeah.
Well, Maida, thank you so much for sharing some of those memories with us. And let me beat your kids to the punch and say happy Mother's Day.
Oh, thank you. Appreciate it.
And we will look forward to visiting with more female members of the Greatest Generation over the course of this program, at least by next Mother's Day, if not sooner. Maida Olson has been our guest today. You can find out more about her online at kmjnow.com or check out the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook. That's our program for today. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.